Well, you know, as we go through the Song of Solomon, last week we looked at the very, very exciting wedding day and wedding night. There's probably no more day that is more exciting for a couple than to remember their wedding days where two become one. And even the wedding night should be very memorable. Interesting statistic that I discovered, and I don't have the exact statistic. All I remember is that it was shocking and it was high. Something like 22% of people on their wedding night don't have sexual relationship or consummate their marriage physically on the wedding night. I don't know. They didn't say why. I would imagine they drank too much or they're too tired or it wasn't anything special to them because they've been living together. I don't know. We can speculate a lot of different reasons. Or it could be conflict. What's that? I think it was in America. I'm not sure. It's just a real loose statistic here. I could hunt the source down probably, but I didn't. I just remember being how surprised that was, given that it was such a special time. And yet we know that one thing is inevitable in any marriage, and that is conflict. It won't be too long after the perfect and ideal wedding and wedding night that a marriage will enter into some kind of conflict. So today we're going to talk about testing love. After Solomon and his lover had gone through this courtship and wedding, their love gets tested in a conflict. And we've seen how in the Song of Solomon, how it breaks down so that the marriage or their courtship is presented, their relationship is presented in three stages. There's the courtship period, and then there's the wedding, the consummation, which is kind of the climax in the middle of the book, and then the maturation of the marriage, which has all to do with the relationship growing together, and part of that is the conflict that they encounter here as they move together through life, and we'll see how their love even deepens through that. So we've covered this ground. They've fallen in love, they've grown in love, they've consummated that love, and now that love is going to be tested before it grows deeper. So today what we'll see is that the lovers have a conflict, and through that conflict she renews her love for him, and then they are reconciled happily at the end. It's all done in very poetic language and symbolism, and we need to try to make some sense of that. And even though, again, the figures of speech are not always clear or leave much to the imagination, the main message and what is happening is clear. And as I study the passage and the commentators, it's amazing how many different views there are on what a figure of speech might mean or something, but all of them agree that what's happened here is that there's been a conflict and then there's been a reconciliation. So that's no problem. So let's look at chapter 5, verses 2 through 8 first, where we see that they have a conflict. It starts out, you remember verse 1 was the affirmation of their consummation, the celebration of their wedding night. Now, verse 2 seems to be a different scene, a different time. And she says, "I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, 'Open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night.'" Now, what is happening here? Is this a dream, or is this a scene that's really happened? She's actually in her bed and has to get up, or she's laying in her bed restlessly thinking and semi-dreaming about something that actually happened. It's not real clear exactly what happened. It seems to be more of a dream, but a dream based on something that happened. So she's restless. She's awake in her bed. She can't sleep. And it seems like she's reciting what happened earlier in the evening, perhaps, when he had knocked on the door and said, "Open for me." And look at the four terms of endearment he uses. My sister, my love or lover, companion, my dove, which was a term of affection we've seen a number of times already, and my perfect one. Sounds like he wants something. He's talking pretty sweet here, isn't he? And the language, "open for me," reminds us of the wedding night language where she was a garden that was locked up and then she opened up to him. So there's all kinds of sexual connotations and references here for those who are interested in reading things in the context, as we all are. And he obviously is knocking on the bedroom door. Maybe he had worked a long day. It was late at night. He talks about being covered with the dew, which means that it's late at night. The dew had settled. And maybe a little too late for her, because verse 3, she says, "I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I defile them?" So she's gotten undressed. She's in bed. She's washed up. And she's going to bed. The original Hebrew for verse 3 is, "I have a headache." And so she rejects his intimacy. She's not in the mood for whatever reason. Doesn't seem to be anything personal against him at all. A little bit of a selfish moment. It's interesting to see the swing of intense passion of the wedding night turn suddenly to apathy. You know, it's like a young couple just looks forward to that wedding night because, you know, it's sex, 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 sex. Then after you're married, well, there's still sex, but it's not quite that. You just take our word for it, single people. It does lose its edge a little bit unless you do some maintenance now and then. The realities of life take over. You get tired. You work a long day. You're in a bad mood. You're distracted. You're thinking about something else. You're sick. We could go on and on. There's a lot of different reasons. We just get selfish sometimes, and perhaps that was her problem. In verse 4, "My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him." Now, some translations read, "My beloved put his hand through the hole in the door," which is the literal reading. The Hebrew word is the word "hole" here. And again, poetry allows our imaginations to wander, and we're not wandering too far, according to some commentators, if we take the hole as a reference to, as a sexual reference. Even the word "hand," the Hebrew word "yad," is used in a number of places in the Bible to speak of the male's sexual organ, and it's used in reference to the monuments that they would put up in ancient Israel to represent the male sexual organ. So there is that here, and that is all legitimate. And she is yearning for him in the sense that she is kind of lovesick for him. And she says, "I arose to open." She has a change of mind, evidently. "I rose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock." Either the myrrh had earlier had reference to the sexual desire, and so he had left that sexual calling card, his scent perhaps, or just that she caught wind of his desire, and so to speak. And so she's picking up on that, and she's recognizing that, but it's too late. So she had rejected his intimacy. In verse 6 through 8, because of that, she opens the door, but it's too late. And she suffers some consequences. "I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone." There are some notes scattered around on the chairs in different places, two pages. "My heart leaped up when he spoke." The idea of "leaped up" has the idea it was kind of overwhelmed or fell into despair, or my heart kind of fell away. Has perhaps the idea of she just was really let down. "She could not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen who went about the city found me, and they struck me, and they wounded me. The keepers of the wall took my veil away from me." Now, earlier, when she had gone looking for a beloved, the watchmen helped her find him, and now it seems they are beating her. And I think what is either a symbolism or this dream sequence. And I don't take it that they literally beat her. But the idea of them beating her probably has the idea of she's feeling some pain, the pain of separation, the pain of guilt for what she has done. They took her veil away from her. She had disrobed to go to bed. Evidently, she'd put it back on and changed her mind, going looking for him. And symbolically, now they've taken that away, so she feels exposed or naked. And these are consequences for her rejection of his intimacy. And so she says to the daughters of Jerusalem, the young maidens, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am lovesick. Tell him, I am lovesick. The word lovesick was used before in chapter 2, in verse 5, when they were courting right before their wedding day, how she was just overcome with love. And here she's feeling that again. But it's too late. He's gone. And so she's feeling that pain of loss and separation because of the decision she made. So a genuine conflict is introduced here when she rejects his intimacy. We know that marriages can have many, many reasons for conflict. They say usually the main reason for divorces is money. I don't buy that. It's usually a bunch of other things. It's usually pride and ego. But there are all kinds of conflicts about children, about money, and about lifestyle. But sex is one of them. Or sex either comes in at the front end of conflict, but it's always at the back end of a conflict. Because it's always one of the first things to suffer in a conflict. And sometimes it actually causes the conflict. There are couples who disagree about the frequency and so forth. I read another interesting statistic this week that whereas we usually picture the man as wanting to have sexual relations more than the women, an actual survey showed that the women desire it slightly more than the men. So that's interesting. Now, the Bible does talk, let me just cover this first. Expect conflict in a marriage. It's going to come at some point. We know that. Every marriage is going to have it. The Song of Solomon is interesting in that it's very realistic. It's idealistic in its sense of love and sex, but it's very realistic in that it introduces conflict into the whole scenario of this marriage. And when there's conflict, there are negative consequences that conflict can bring, so we have to be very careful about how we handle that conflict. The consequences, I think, have spiritual ramifications, emotional ramifications, and like I said, there's always the physical fallout from these. So a healthy, godly marriage ought to be constantly on guard for conflict and have a way of resolving conflict. There is a time for biblical abstinence. Perhaps the Shulamite woman hadn't read 1 Corinthians 7. Oh, I know she hadn't read 1 Corinthians 7. It wasn't written for another 1,000 years. But what does 1 Corinthians 7, verses 2 through 5 say? If we look at that passage, and I'll read it, it says, nevertheless, he talks about it's good for a man not to touch a woman, and most people believe that means in a physical, sexual way. And then verse 2 says, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. In a sexual way, he's speaking. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. Come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So there is biblical abstinence taught in marriage. First of all, it says don't withhold sex from one another. The norm of a marriage is that your body really doesn't belong to you and that you should be willing to share with your mate. And he has a right to your body. She has a right to your body. This would have been good for the Shulamite to know. In spite of her bad mood, perhaps she could have made some kind of compromise. But there are stipulations that for postponing sexual relationships, not for canceling, totally canceling, but postponing sexual relationships. It says, first of all, you have to be in agreement. It's a mutual agreement. It's not one person saying, well, I've decided to postpone sex indefinitely. And without consultation of the other person. So Paul makes it sure there's mutual consent. And secondly, he says, for a period of time. For a time, he says. So it's not indefinitely. It's not for a long period, but it's implied a short period of time. And then here's one that you can try. I don't know if this is going to work, but for fasting and prayer. Anybody ever use that as an excuse? I haven't. Everybody looking down. But that is a biblical reason for abstinence. And I think the idea there is to devote yourself to deepening your relationship with God. And that's really a smart move if there's tension in the physical relationship, to take a pause in the action, and, so to speak, and deepen your relationship with God, because that's the foundation for everything else. So biblical abstinence is a biblical abstinence, but it's tightly controlled with these stipulations in 1 Corinthians 7. And as the Shulamite found, there are dangers of withholding sexual relationships. If we put together, you know, what we see there in the Song of Solomon with 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we see, first of all, that be careful that you don't violate the scriptural directives that we have there. If one of the partners wants to be intimate and the other does not, carefully and no agreement can be reached, carefully judge whether you're in violation of the scriptural directives that we just read. And be aware that that any conflict that's introduced, of course, can damage a marital relationship. Conflicts can come from many directions and for many reasons, but the effects of that can remain. Anger that turns to bitterness. Bitterness turns to resentment, to unforgiveness, to depression, to guilt, to hatred. There's all kinds of problems that can be introduced. And, of course, 1 Corinthians says that a lack of sexual relationships can cause the other person to be tempted by Satan, or both people to be tempted by Satan. So there is a natural urge that at some point, I'm not a biology teacher or sexual therapist, but there's an actual urge that at some point needs to be satisfied in both the male and female. And there needs to be a way for that to be satisfied. God has given us a way for that to be satisfied, and we're not to play around with that need that we all have. Just like we hunger, and if we don't eat, the less we eat, the more we hunger, and our appetite grows. And it's the same. We're made in the same way as sexual beings, and that's why I think Paul says in 1 Corinthians, he says, you know, it's better to marry than to burn. At some point, you know, you want to cut your losses or cut your temptation and get married and have that need satisfied, so you're not in that place of temptation. Well, let's move on to verse 9. Verse 9 seems to be where we transition out of a dreamlike phase back into reality. And she's dealing now with the relationship. And she's talking to the daughters of Jerusalem, first of all. And basically, what they are talking to her and what they seem to be saying is, you know, why is he so special? What is your beloved more than another? O fairest among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you so charge us? Why should we go looking for him? Taunting her a little bit, you know. And I think taunting her to say, tell us, what, you know, do you really love him? Well, why is he so special? And that causes her to remember then his uniqueness. My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. Here you're going to find some descriptions of him. The most graphic description of an individual human being in all of the Bible. I'm not speaking sexually, I'm just speaking the physical appearance is even more detailed here than his description of her, it seems. But she just describes him in recounting why she loves him and how attractive he is. He's white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. 10,000 is just a poetic term to mean numberless. His head is like the finest gold, obviously speaking of purity and value. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves. We've seen that quite often, representing innocence and purity. By the rivers of water washed with milk and fitly set, just, I think, the appearance of his face. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with pearl. His body is carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. There's the idea of strength there in verse 15 with the marble and the cedars of Lebanon. And then I think beauty and sexual reference and all attractiveness in the other references. We won't go pick through them one at a time. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. The reference to his mouth here could be his physical mouth, but it seems like she's speaking of his speech, which before had been described as sweet as apples, if you remember. So she remembers his uniqueness. And then she remembers their commitment in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. The daughters of Jerusalem say to her, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you?" Now she had asked them to help them look for him. Now they're asking her as if she really already knew. She knew him well enough to know where he would be. And that does seem to be the case, because she answers readily, "My beloved has gone to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies." Well, she answers, she knows where he is. He's in the garden. Now, what is the garden? Some have taken the garden as in the spices there, since that language had been used before. She had been a garden, and the spices were used with their lovemaking to refer to that he's. It's a sexual reference that she's been reunited with him in a lovemaking episode. Others take it that he is away doing business. He's feeding his flock among the lilies. He's taking care of the country. As the chief shepherd of the country, Solomon had to oversee a lot of people, and his business as the king kept him out among the people. So as a distraction away from the conflict, you know, men often bury themselves in their work or something like that. The third idea the third idea would be a physical garden. He's actually going to a place. And we know that Solomon had a lot of gardens. Ecclesiastes 2 tells us, and 1 Corinthians 4 tells us that he had a lot of gardens. So he had many to choose from. Perhaps he had a favorite place that she knew he liked to go and reflect and think. If Karen and I were getting in an argument, somebody say, "Where's Charlie?" She'd probably say, "Oh, he's out fishing." And she'd probably say, "Out the Nolan River." I mean, you get to know the person well enough that when somebody wants to get away and think, that's where they go. He's out in his garage, you know, whatever it is. She knew him well enough that he was in this place. So that's possible, it's a physical place. The fourth possibility would just be a figurative idea that he's thinking. He's resting, he's found a place, and he's reflecting on all of this. But what is absent is any kind of sense of antagonism or anger. It's a very peaceful scene. He's finding peace and rest in all of this. And she knows that. And so she is able to affirm their love in verse 3. "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." Now, she had used that language before in chapter 2 in verse 16. But there she had reversed it. She said, "My beloved is mine, and I am his." Now she says, "I am his, and he is mine." She puts herself, her own commitment first. "I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine." But there's a recitation, a memory of the commitment that they had made before their marriage to be uniquely with one another. So she remembered their commitment. I think this shows us that what she does is wise, or what the daughters of Jerusalem prompt her to do is wise. They ask her, why are you looking for this guy? What's so special about him? And that causes her to remember the love that she had for him. Isn't it so easy in a conflict to think about all the bad things that your mate has done and to list them? You know, sometimes Karen, I told Karen this before. She doesn't like me to use examples, but this is about me. That I've been tempted to just make a list of stuff, you know, a list of grievances. And every time I do that, I think of 1 Corinthians 13 that says, "Love keeps no record of wrongs. And so I always resist that temptation to make that list, you know. But what I have done on occasion, I've written all the things that I've appreciated about Karen and the things I admire about her to remind me, why am I so mad? Well, these are the things that that attracted me to her and that I love and why I love her. And the Daughters of Jerusalem perhaps take the role here of a very wise marriage counselor. They ask her to say, why are you looking for the guy? You know, and she then recounts why she loves him so much. So it's a good conflict, way to resolve conflict is to remember why you love your mate and then remember the commitment that you've made. That's what marriage is about, isn't it? It's a commitment, a public commitment, first of all. It's a commitment to one another, first of all, and then it's a public commitment to your society and community of people. And then for Christians, it's a commitment to God as well. Malachi chapter 3 talks about the covenant that you have made. And in Matthew 19 and verse 6, Jesus said, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. What God has joined together. And so God, in recognition of the covenant commitment that we make and agree to with one another, joins us together. I really think that we'll find that the commitment alone is what will sometimes very often keep a marriage together. If there is a commitment not to leave, if there's a commitment not to walk away, then the only thing you can do is eventually go through some kind of problem solving together at some point. In chapter 6, verses 4 through 13, we see a reconciliation here. He reassures her. Oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah and as lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Tirzah and Jerusalem were known as the two most beautiful cities in Israel. So he's praising her beauty, or an army with all of its colorful banners stretched out, perhaps on the battlefield, or all the colorful banners are a beautiful sight. Turn your eyes from away from me, for they have overcome me. The word overcome has the idea of overwhelm me. Some people see a sexual reference there. He's getting turned on by looking at her, or her looking at him. And then he recites some of the things about her that he remembers. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. That should sound familiar to you, the same terms that he used for her previously. Now, what's interesting about that is that he's saying, hey, I love you like I've always loved you. He brings up no bitterness, no anger, no resentment, no retaliation. He's been thinking about it, reflecting on it, and she comes to him, and he just begins to praise her. He had been loving all the time. He is readily willing to forgive, and she kind of knew that, which is why she so readily went to him. And they had that strong foundation of commitment and mutual love, and they weren't afraid to approach one another. In verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. Poetically, the increasing numbers here just could mean an indefinite, innumerable amount. In other words, Solomon is not counting literally the number of queens and concubines in a harem, but he's just saying there's just numberless women, but you're the perfect one. You're above them all. If he is giving a literal number and speaking of a literal harem, then it could be his harem that he had already had from foreign alliances that he's formed with other nations, or it could be the harem that he inherited, if this was early in his life, that he inherited from his father David. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, and the queens and the concubines, they praised her. Verse 9 is just using superlative language to say, you are unique, you are special, you are not the only daughter of the mother, probably more the favorite one of your mother, and this very special, unique one. So in other words, she's in his view, and he's saying in the view of all the other women, view of your own family, you're just tops. And so she rejoices to turn to him. Verse 10 continues that praise, by the way. Who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? She reflects the light of the morning and the fairness of the moon and the brightness of the sun and all of its glory. She called herself in chapter 1 dark, and she kind of felt bad about how dark she was in her appearance, but he doesn't see that. He only sees the brightness of her countenance. What we see probably is a bright, cheery, smiling face. So she says, I went down to the garden of nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. She's going now to the garden, a physical garden perhaps. Some say she's going back to her homeland of Lebanon. I take it figuratively. She's seeing if love is there, and love is in the air, so to speak, and love is still blooming. And before I was even aware, she says, or before I realized it, some translations, as the chariots, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people, or he set me on a chariot. The idea seems to be, but suddenly, you know, he was so ready to reconcile. He was so ready to have her back that he just puts her on his chariot and sweeps her away. Whether literally or figuratively is unclear. But the point is, he was just so ready to have her back that she just rides away triumphantly in the royal chariot, and all the people are looking on. And it shows her willingness to come his direction and his willingness to meet her and receive her and total forgiveness and take her away. Now, verse 13, return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. That's evidently the either the daughters of Jerusalem or the friends who are gathered there, and they see her being taken away, and they could be saying, turn back, turn back. We want to, you're so beautiful, we want to enjoy your beauty. The verb there, turn, turn, some have taken that, the repetition of that four times here, to mean spin, as in a dance. Because the next verse, the second part of the verse, talks about dancing. And so they're saying, hey, let, you know, as you celebrate, dance. Or this could be speaking the dance of the wedding night, some people think as well. What would we see in the Shulamite, as it were, the dance of the two camps? Well, first of all, what's interesting here is that this is the first time she's called the Shulamite. And we've been calling her that since the beginning of the book, but this is the first time that she's named by name. So there seems to be that deeper level of experience and intimacy. We know her name, and he uses her name twice here. Interesting thing about the name Shulamite is in the Hebrew, it would be Shulamith. And what many have observed and noted is that Solomon, the Shulamo, would be the masculine form of the name, and Shulamith would be the counterpart or the feminine form of the name, much like we would say actor, actress, Solomon, Shulamite, or Shulamo, Shulamith. And there's probably no coincidence. It works poetically, whether it's her real name or not. And as people have believed, the word in Hebrew for peace is what? Shalom. And people believe that these names are based on the word shalom, which is very likely. So what you have here is a beautiful, beautiful picture of Solomon, a man of peace, reconciling with his wife Shulamith, in this whole relationship of peace. They found a deeper peace now in their relationship with one another. It could be by poetic design, and you know, I don't put it past I don't put it past God to do something like that. That's a stupid statement, but I don't put it past God to design that in the language. I'm always amazed at how God crafts his words in the original language, and we miss so much of it in the English. But to read it as a Hebrew and to see these terms and to know that Shalom and Solomon and Shulamith all have as their base peace, and to see them coming together in this beautiful reconciliation of two souls that were estranged and alienated and coming together, it's just a beautiful picture. And that's why verse 13 has them dancing at the end of our section today. In this very enigmatic statement, as it were, the dance of the two camps. Wow. You know, first of all, this is probably, we can't dogmatically say what this means. What we do know is the word dance is in there, and then the idea of two camps or two armies is in there. Literally, it's Mahanaim in the Hebrew, which means double camp. So you have the word dance and double camp. So what's going on? There's all kinds of explanations. There's all kinds of options. I'll tell you the one that I prefer and that makes a lot of sense to me. In Genesis chapter 32, in verse 32, you have the place Mahanaim mentioned. It was the place where Jacob camped. And you remember he had been warned that Esau was looking for him. Jacob was traveling back towards Israel, and he had been warned that Esau was looking for him. So what did he do? He took his camp and did what? He split it into two pieces. So that Jacob killed one half, he'd still have half. Half of them would be spared. And so it says in chapter 32, verse 2, Genesis, he called that place Mahanaim, double camp. Okay? So he finally meets Esau, and he's expecting to get slaughtered. And he says, hey, Esau, I'll give you, half of my camp. Esau says, no, I don't want that. Don't worry about it. And Esau says, come on, I'll go before you. A nice generous offer to go in front, be in the dangerous position. Jacob says, no, I don't want that. And it's back and forth. They're trying to outdo each other with gifts. So what was supposed to be a terrible bloodbath ended up being a beautiful reconciliation. You have Jacob dividing his army into two camps, Mahanaim. And then you have, if you want to, Jacob and Esau, the two camps, Mahanaim, coming together in a beautiful, overwhelming reconciliation where they could not do each other with gifts towards one another. And here, the very same word, the word double camps here is the translation of it, but the word is, in the Hebrew, Mahanaim. Did the author of the Song of Solomon, or the divine author, have in mind for us to recall that story of one of the most beautiful reconciliations in all of Scripture that was supposed to be contentious, two family members who were fighting, and yet blood was thicker than water, and their commitment to one another ended up in a beautiful resolution, reconciliation, and peaceful relationship? And that's why the celebration is so intense. And if it's a dance, then it's a dance of the two camps. maybe that was the celebration that was called for. But it's exuberance here that a marriage relationship that had been estranged and had entered into conflict was resolved so beautifully and peacefully, where the two parties came back together as one. And in a marriage relationship, when there is conflict, we know that we need to be quick to forgive. That's one of the things we see here. She showed no bitterness that he had left. He shows no bitterness that she had gone after him and when they reunited. And instead, he just recalls his love for her. And then I think what is implied in this is that their love deepens as the two camps are brought together. So conflict can deepen love. Again, this isn't a class in marriage, or I'm not a marriage counselor anymore anyway. But I think there's some things that, I've gathered from life and from experience, from the Scriptures, and from doing some counseling and reading about it, that there are ways to resolve conflict biblically. And I think the most important thing is to remember the commitment to your marriage. And I say, if you forget everything else and have that, you will somehow get through it and figure it out. But you got to have that commitment. If that commitment is not there, then it is too easy sometimes to bail. You have You have to remember the commitment to your marriage. That leaves you nowhere else to go except through the problem. Don't let anger brood. The Scriptures exhort us in Ephesians 4 to not let the sun go down on our anger. To don't bottle it up and let it grow into resentment or even depression. I like what I've heard other places and learned some time ago is don't react to your mate, but respond to God. The issue is not so much what did somebody do to me, but God, what are you saying to me in all of this? And that takes the edge off. It takes the daggers out of your relationship to the other person, and you're dealing with God about the situation. And then give God room to work. Remember that God is doing something in your mate's life as well as your life, and sometimes we just tend to get in the way and interfere with what he's trying to do. We'll push things along by nagging or pushing or yelling and trying to get our own way. And in God's timing, in God's way, that person is just not ready. Your mate is not ready to do that yet. Even when counseling is sought, you know, somebody drags their mate to counseling, it's more with the idea of, hey, you hold them so I can beat them up, you know, rather than let's work this thing out and see what God wants in this. We give God room and time to work as well. And then you have to forgive at some point. There has to be forgiveness expressed. And that usually means that there has to be repentance as well. So, you know, what I found is useful in all relationships, marriage, fathering, being a son, just being in relationship to anybody I find it very useful to think, how does God treat us? How does God treat me as a son? How does God treat me as a father, as my father? So how should I treat somebody? And then if Christ is my bridegroom, how does he treat the church? How does he treat me as a bridegroom? I think it's always good to end up there. And I think the Song of Solomon is pushing us in that direction, as we'll see in the last chapter. But how does God treat us? There's a misspelling in your notes. God allows negative consequences in our life. That's unavoidable. Even in the idealistic book of the Song of Solomon, you have conflict introduced here. So we're going to have to learn to deal with it, first of all. But it's there for a purpose. God's ultimate purpose is to make us Christ-like. We might be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, Romans 8:29. But along the way, he deals with us gently and patiently. And that's how we should deal with others. And God is committed to us. He says nothing can separate us from his love. He assures us with that kind of assurance. Neither death, nor life, nor height, or breadth, or any kind of power, or any person, or any danger, nothing can separate us from his love. That's how strong his love for us. That's his model for us. And then he's quick to forgive us. He's quick to forgive us because Jesus Christ already paid the price to deal with all the issues of our sin. And Ephesians 4:32 says that we need to be quick to forgive one another. And if Jesus taught if he has forgiven us, we should forgive one another. And the end result is that in a conflict, as we deal with God about issues, we always come out in a deeper love for him. And likewise in a marriage, when we are in a conflict and we deal with that conflict, we can come out with a deeper love for one another, a deeper knowledge of who our mate is and what makes them so unique and wonderful for us, and a greater commitment to them, a greater sense of hope that you could work through other conflicts in the future. And here we have a book that's written as an idealistic view of love, sex, and marriage. And then it introduces conflict. And then you could say, well, it has kind of an idealistic view of how quickly the conflict is resolved, because it's not that easy in real life. And I agree that the Song of Solomon is an idealistic book. It was written that way. But I think at some place in the Scripture, God had to give us that kind of picture of what it should be like. Even though we all fall short in love and in sex and in marriage and conflict resolution. That's the real world that we live in. And in our sinful natures, we'll always fall short. But we will have this ideal that we can look at and learn from and find encouragement there. Not discouragement that we've maybe blown it in certain areas or we weren't able to resolve a conflict and it ended in divorce or something like that. That's the real world that we live in. But the idealistic is there to help us where it can along the way as we learn from it. So a beautiful section here, which represents the realities of married life and yet ends happily for this couple, and perhaps can help you in the future someday.